there's nothing different about what he did in pulling that man out of the water than what he might do in a combat zone in reacting to enemy contact.
An Anchorage-based Army Staff Sergeant wins the prestigious Soldier's Medal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Petersburg asks the state to relax a marijuana regulation.
For lots of municipalities, it poses the business challenge.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Crude oil prices continue to fall across the United States, with Brent crude setting an 11-year low, dipping below $33 per barrel this morning. Alaska North Slope crude is following a similar track, coming in at $34.82 per barrel on January 5th, the most recently reported price. That's its third lowest mark since January 20th, 2009, when, according to data from the Alaska Department of Revenue, ANS West Coast hit $34.49 per barrel. Though prices have recovered slightly from this morning, Brent crude and West Texas Intermediate are still below the $34 mark. Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz addressed a group of state lawmakers today, presenting them with the city's one big funding priority.
So our proposed legislative program is fairly straightforward this year. We're going to focus on making sure that there's money so we can move ahead with port modernization.
The administration won't have a specific dollar amount in its request until later in the session, once the Anchorage Assembly grants its approval. But the administration laid out a tentative funding strategy, one made up of cash on hand, statewide bonds, and payments from an ongoing lawsuit. Berkowitz described the port as a series of rusted-out tubes, one that requires $5 million in yearly maintenance, but is ill-equipped to handle increased vessel traffic or even minor natural disasters. According to figures from Port Director Steve Rebuffo, the total improvements are expected to come to more than half a billion dollars. Speaking to eight members of the State House and Senate, most of whom are local Democrats, Rebuffo highlighted the statewide dimension of a utility usually framed as a local concern.
About 85% of all Alaskans are serviced by products that come across the docks.
The administration also mentioned operating budget requests for programs dealing with domestic violence and sexual assault prevention. And amid a session likely to be shaped by the state's budget deficit, Berkowitz asked legislators to relax restrictions governing state-issued funds, a step he said would give municipalities more tools for dealing with financial woes. A soldier stationed at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson is set to receive one of the nation's highest military awards tomorrow. The Soldier's Medal is given for heroic actions taken by military personnel in civilian life, far away from combat zones. According to Army officials, it's the first time a soldier in Alaska has been awarded the honor for a rescue that happened in state. And as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, it started with a fishing trip.
Army Staff Sergeant Joshua Schneiderman has been in the military for more than 20 years.
I have total that I can talk about. I have 63 months in combat right now.
The Soldier's Medal is a huge deal and extremely rare. It recognizes a voluntary risk of life in a non-combat setting. For Schneiderman, that happened in June of 2014 when he was showing his wife at a dip net on the Copper River.
I heard some screaming upriver and couldn't really tell what was going on. A couple people started running. And then I looked over, and this gentleman was like almost in the middle of the river. He was about up to his chin in the water, and he still had his dip net in one hand, and he was flaring his hand and out of the water with the other hand. And I was like, just let go of the net. The guy had this monster king salmon in his net, and that's why he didn't want to let go.
Schneiderman's read was that the situation looked bad, really bad.
Nobody was really making any effort to do anything with this guy. He was just dying. He's getting ready to die down the river.
He ran to his truck, grabbed a life vest, and sprinted back to the bank.
I got about 20 feet from him, and I threw him the life vest, and I took about two more steps and I jumped in the water, which is about 10 feet away.
Schneiderman's chest waders quickly filled with water as the current carried him out, and he grabbed a rock with one hand and stretched the other one as far out as he could.
And I just made every effort I could to even make fingertip contact with this guy, and somehow we were able to get fingertips, and we just walked our fingertips into our hands, and I just grabbed this guy. And
he pulled him to safety. The king salmon, though, that was lost to the river. After things settled down a bit, Schneiderman walked back to his truck, not making too much out of the rescue.
It kind of hit me when he came up to my truck, and he hugged me for like 20 minutes. That's when I knew that like it was surreal. And I was like, wow, okay, I really did just save this guy's life.
Schneiderman still actually doesn't seem very worked up about it. The more I press Schneiderman on how come he and not anyone else that was on the river dove in to help, the more he shrugs and says, that's just what you do. It's how he's trained.
Like I said, I got 63 months in combat. When you return from a war zone, you're changed. Your environment that you know it back here is no longer the same. I don't want to say you're walking on eggshells, but you have a more heightened sense of awareness.
There's nothing different about what he did in pulling that man out of the water than what he might do in a combat zone in reacting to enemy contact.
Lieutenant Colonel Alan Brown is a spokesman for the Army in Alaska and says the Soldier's Medal is important because it commends what he sees as military values applied even when a soldier might not technically be on the clock.
But that's what selfless service really truly is. And for us to say we're only going to adhere to that value when we're wearing the uniform or when we're on duty or in a combat zone, that's not consistent with what the Army is about.
News about the award came to Schneiderman last month. He says since then, he hasn't really talked much about it, but the timing couldn't be better.
This is a great way to go out. I said I submitted my retirement paperwork Monday, and this is going to be a great ending to a 23-year career.
Still, Schneiderman does have one regret about that day.
It was a terrible day. We didn't catch any fish.
The awards ceremony is Friday at J-Bear. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A jailbreak and escape were unsuccessful after community members intervened in the Yukon village of Pilot Station. KYUK's Lakeed Rashavis reports.
Pilot Station community members thwarted an escape after two men were briefly on the run following an armed jailbreak. Alaska State Troopers say Dale Fancyboy, 22, reportedly went into the Pilot Station jail with a shotgun Tuesday just before midnight. Fancyboy held up an unarmed jail guard and removed two prisoners from the cell, 19-year-old Thomas Heckman and 22-year-old Dion Joseph. The men were booked on theft, burglary, and assault charges. While leaving, troopers say Fancyboy also threatened two village police officers who had just arrived, but the rest didn't go as planned. Megan Peters is the spokeswoman for Alaska State Troopers.
Well, yesterday after the breakout occurred, a group of villagers got together and first they found Fancyboy and brought him to the jail and turned him in.
The two escapees were still at large.
We had troopers fly out yesterday morning and go to search the village and try to find the two escapees that Fancyboy helped break out. We weren't able to find them right away, but we were still in the village when one of the family members showed up at the jail with the two escapees and turned them over to troopers.
The men were taken back into custody. Troopers took all three individuals to the Yukon Kuskokwim Correctional Center. It's unknown what additional charges the men may face. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Lakeedra Chavis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating Russian Orthodox Christmas in Nanwalek.
The kids, if they don't know who they are, it's being super, and if they don't know their culture and their religion, they just get lost.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
The UAS School of Management offers Bachelor of Business Administration degree programs online with an emphasis in human resources and management information systems. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Petersburg is asking the state to relax limitations on where marijuana businesses can open their doors this year. Petersburg's assembly approved a resolution on Monday asking for a smaller setback for pot businesses. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
New state regulations say a marijuana business must be at least 500 feet from a school, youth center, church, or jail, which would put most of downtown Petersburg off limits. Petersburg's assembly considered a resolution saying the 500-foot setback severely reduces the ability of a licensed marijuana business to exist in the retail business district in downtown Petersburg. The resolution asks for the state to change the setback to 200 feet. Assemblymember Jay Stanton Greger said he was not really optimistic the state would change that regulation.
However, for lots of municipalities, it poses the business challenge. It's free market. It's a capitalist society we live in, and for this particular industry, that 500-foot setback is more restrictive than alcohol, for instance, and I think it would give beyond Petersburg, other local communities, a broader scope to do business.
Stanton Greger thought it couldn't hurt to ask, however. The vote was 6-0 in favor of the resolution, which will be sent on to the state. The relaxed setback idea has been proposed in Sitka, and it was one recommendation that came out of Petersburg's Marijuana Regulation Advisory Committee. That committee has met several times since it formed last March. However, the committee's chair, Stanton Greger, told the assembly this week they've been unable to come up with other recommendations about a local ordinance.
At the December 2015 meeting, the majority of committee members had either not read the state regulations at all or had very little working knowledge of them. Therefore, the committee is unable to provide clear and/or useful recommendations to the assembly at this time. It is my opinion that the Assembly may need to address this issue on its own, as the committee is thus far ineffective.
The Assembly agreed to have staff draft an ordinance for local marijuana businesses. Borough Manager Steve Giesbrecht thought it could take some time for staff to draft that language and check it with the borough's attorney. Local governments can prohibit pot businesses outright or restrict the number or location for licensed businesses, as well as hours of operation. A local ordinance could also establish a tax on pot. The state anticipates it could be accepting license applications for pot cafes and growers online by next month. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Petersburg's nonprofit cold storage plant is serving a wider group of customers than it did when it began about 10 years ago. It's still mostly freezing fish for big processors, but it's also taking in groceries and sport anglers' catches. Coastal Esca's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Petersburg Community Cold Storage holds up to 500,000 pounds of product at a time, and during its decade of operation, that product has been mostly pink salmon from big processors. But that's been changing.
It's kind of expanded beyond just the idea of having seafood in there.
Liz Cabrera is coordinator of the Petersburg Economic Development Council, which owns the plant. She says it's freezing and storing fish from more small processors, as well as local businesses.
The restaurants and the grocery stores and even some of the remote lodges will bring things in, and even the canneries will store groceries there.
It's also being used more by hunters, charter operators, and sport anglers without enough freezer space. Cabrera says one person brought in a moose. Petersburg's cold storage plant continues to give priority to its anchor tenant, Ocean Beauty.
So if they get a large delivery or a large run of fish that they can't really handle at their plant, they can bring it over and freeze it and hold it at the facility. They can also do freight consolidation. So maybe they don't have a container load yet of something that they're providing to a certain market, so that they can hold product until they have a full container load.
The plant, on Petersburg's waterfront, a half mile south of downtown, plays a somewhat different role for smaller seafood processors.
They'll hold frozen product there until maybe later in the season when they have time to smoke it or do some value-added processing. If they're doing custom processing work, maybe they don't have enough room in their storage areas, and so they'll bring excess over and hold it there for their customers until their customers can pick it up.
Volume and income is better this year than last. Smaller fish runs during the past fiscal year brought in gross revenues of about $125,000. July, August, and September of last year alone brought in 90% of that amount. It's representative of the ups and downs the facility has seen as the salmon catch ebbs and flows and producers close or change hands. Cabrera says overall, the operation has paid its own way.
So we kind of try to even it out on the good years and save the money for the year that we know is going to be a down year.
Petersburg Community Cold Storage construction was funded by the State Fisheries Economic Development Program and the Petersburg Economic Fund. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
The Juneau Utility Advisory Board has new recommendations on how the municipality should deal with its waste. Right now, about 7,000 tons of the city's sludge is barged to Oregon, costing about $2 million each year. City Engineer Rory Watt said the advisory board met multiple times over the past year to discuss solutions.
What the utility board essentially found is that indeed they agree that the dryer is our best option.
Watt says, think of the dryer as a big oven. It turns the waste into pellets, which can then be used for topsoil, revegetation, or road projects. The upfront cost would be more than $16 million, and it would be located in the Mendenhall Wastewater Treatment Plant.
If we built the dryer, and depending on fuel prices, it's operating the dryer is probably only around $800,000 a year.
The lifespan of the dryer is about 20 years. Another option, contract with a private company that would bury the waste on land in South Douglas. Partners Bicknell and Backfill Incorporated are proposing barging the city's waste to 100 acres of remote land. The company would be called Juneau Monofill. The operational cost is about $1.8 million per year, more than the dryer option, but the upfront costs are less. Juneau Monofill is asking for a 10-year contract with the city with the option to cancel in 5. At a meeting on Monday, Juneau Assemblymember Debbie White said she wanted to hear more about the company's plans.
I started out with this thinking that I wanted the dryer, but the fact is I like the idea of getting some time for technology to catch up to where we're at.
The dryer option would take about 18 months to get started with permitting. It's unknown how long until the monofill would be operational. The Assembly asked the Utility Advisory Board to come back with more information for their next meeting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
At the Salmon Project, they know that Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Join them this winter as they journey across the state and hear the stories of Alaskans whose lives are amazingly similar to yours, even if they live 2,000 miles away. Learn more at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough is unveiling a new air quality app for mobile phones and devices. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the app is intended to drive up public awareness of local air quality and assist reporting concerns.
Ron Lovell is the Fairbanks Borough's air quality manager. He says the new smartphone application allows users to check out air quality at 5 sites around the borough, see if there are burn restrictions, and scope out current weather conditions.
So it kind of turns into a one-stop shopping to where an individual can see what the concentrations are, any burn restrictions that are in place, and how it might affect them at their residence.
Lovell says personal computer users can access the app using web browsers. And he adds, there is a link on the app if users see a troubling event.
An individual can either go to the EC website to see trending data, or they can go to the borough's main website to our complaint portal. So they can fill out a complaint directly from their phone.
The bottom line, says Lovell, is to raise public awareness and stay compliant with federal standards. He says the borough's website has steadily drawn people to it as winter has set in. In September, just over 500 people visited, and by December, that number had risen to more than 12,000. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
An abandoned downtown Fairbanks landmark will see new life as a private school. Spruce Tree Montessori School has purchased the old Alaska Railroad Depot from the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The depot, located behind the newspaper's building, has sat idle since the railroad sold it to the paper and relocated to a new Fairbanks station in 2005. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the school plans to transform the languishing property.
The aging metal and glass front former railroad depot will get some love as the new home of the Spruce Tree Montessori School, but director Sabrina Binkley says the 1960s-era depot's basic look will remain unchanged.
We love the retro architecture. We'll probably give it a facelift with new paint on the exterior, some new windows.
Binkley says the railroad depot will accommodate increasing enrollment, noting that the school has gone from 7 to 48 students since opening 4 years ago, stretching the capacity of its current location in a log building on 2nd Avenue. She adds that interior renovations at the train depot, scheduled to be done by next fall, will provide space for up to 100 kids.
The new building is about double the size as far as square footage goes, and so that will allow us to add another preschool and kindergarten classroom, create a larger elementary classroom, and then most importantly, we'll have our own gym and multi-purpose space.
Binkley says renovations will also include addition of a full kitchen and library, plus upgrades to the surrounding property.
We plan to demo most of the front parking lot to create a beautiful playground and activity space, probably to include grassy fields, a garden, outdoor classroom space, and potentially winter activity space like for sledding and an ice rink in the future.
Binkley would not share a purchase price, but the railroad depot was listed at $250,000. The land it sits on is owned by the Alaska Railroad and will be leased to the school. Binkley says the railroad depot purchase and renovations will not impact tuition. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Today is Orthodox Christmas, which is celebrated in many communities across Alaska. KBBI's Daisha Eaton takes us to the Alaska Native village of Nanwalik on the southern Kenai Peninsula, where the celebration is in full swing.
That's the sound of people singing in celebration of Orthodox Christmas at the St. Sergis and Herman Church in Nanwalik. In the community of about 300 people of Aleutic Sukupiak descent, they sing in Slavonic, a liturgical language used by the Orthodox Church in Russia and Eastern Europe, a remnant of the fur trade era and Russian colonialism. Wednesday, the holiday kicked off around the state with Christmas Eve services followed by starring. Nanwalik resident Sperry Ash says the practice represents the journey of the three wise men.
Each region in Alaska that practices this style of caroling, what we call Slavic, they all have variations. But generally, they follow a star, a wooden frame that's decorated with the icon of Nativity in the center, and that star guides the carolers house to house.
Food and treats are offered to the visitors at each house.
Starring is a really enjoyable event to be able to go house to house and see each family and greet them. And just that fellowship is really special at this time of year.
Nanwalik used to be known as English Bay. The village was originally the site of a Russian trading post called Alexandrovsky during the fur trade of the 1700s. Locals changed the community name back to the original native name of Nanwalik, meaning place by a lagoon. Nanwalik is situated along Cook Inlet at the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. Starring starts at the chief's house. Subdeacon F.M. Moonen says a prayer. Then the singing starts in front of an icon on a shelf beside the family Christmas tree. Chief John Kvesnikov says the tradition and the story of the Nativity are important to preserve in the face of outside influences.
We got, you know, a lot of influence, internet and all this new technology. You know, kids are seeing, you know, they see outside, but people can see and hear too. And, you know, it's like, and I'm glad they're still holding on to it because I think it makes you a better person, I think, you know, you just... It makes you want to help people who need help.
Next, they'll star at the houses of newborn babies and elders, like Sally Ash, Sperry's mother. She's the Sukstun language teacher in Nanwalik, and she says she's teaching all her grandchildren the language. Ash says she enjoys the Slavonic hymns, but says in the future she'd like to see some songs sung in Sukstun, too.
The kids, if they don't know who they are, as being super, and if they don't know their culture and their religion, they just get lost, you know, just be a lost soul, and then they follow what's on TV. And so I think it's just really important that they just know not only Christmas, but Pascha and, you know, other major feasts we celebrate throughout the year. So it's very important, yeah.
Pascha is Easter. Some holiday tables will have traditional akten, or as the locals call them, bedarkies, or in Sukbiak, oritak, gathered from the local reef, along with dry fish and seal oil, says Ash. Food is a big part of the holidays in Nanwalik, and the table is a mix of Russian, Sukbiak, and Western influences. She has a pot of turkey soup on the stove, she says, because the store had to give away defrosting turkeys due to a power outage last week, and having the power out has set everyone behind on their holiday preparations. With the power back on, people are out to get what they need, like Adele Kvasnikov, the chief's niece.
We have pilot crackers, so we're going to do a traditional pilot cracker with salmon eggs and cream cheese. And my husband loves to use that Nelly's chili, and we mix it with fresh cheddar cheese, and we melt it together, and we get tortilla chips and use it as a dip. So we're going to do that on our table this year. And I grabbed a couple of small candies and stuff, for stocking stuffers for my kids.
Orthodox Christians celebrate Christmas on January 7th, according to the Julian calendar. Starring will continue for the next several days. The holiday season runs through the Orthodox New Year on January 14th. The holidays celebrated in Anchorage, in the YK Delta, in Southeast and Kodiak, and along the Aleutian Chain, as well as on the southern Kenai Peninsula, where Nanwalik is. In Nanwalik, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Lakedra Chavis in Bethel, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Nanwalik. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Happy New Year! Start the year off right by filing your 2016 PFD application. Don't forget to sign your application electronically or by printing a signature page. The deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st, 2016. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artists Award Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.